Welcome back to a new episode of Brain Pops, the podcast approaching mental and physical challenges behind the scenes of professional sports. This is episode 56, and with me, as always, is Lennart Stechmann. Lennart, how are you?
Thank you so much for this introduction. Hey, Dom, I'm good. Glad to be back. Excited for our guest today. How are you today?
I'm good. Again, it's daytime, a little different. We usually record in the evening, so I would say again, I have a little bit more energy, so that's good. And today we have a guest. I mean, that's probably, well, he will be talking a lot, but I'm probably going to be talking a lot too, right?
Yes, yes. This is your thing, something you've been on my ears for weeks or months now, using this First Beat system. We'll get into that, what it really is, a little bit later, I think. Because, yeah, like you said, this is your thing, and you found another expert for this. And, yeah, I'm really excited to hear about this more, to learn about this more, even though I already know how excited you are. And usually when you're excited, this means something good.
Yeah, and his name is Sean Connedy. I hope I pronounced him right.
That's right.
And he's already with us. Before we call him in, I'm just going to give you guys like a few cliff notes about him. Right now, he's the director of athletic performance for the Missouri Tigers since 2022, men's basketball, NCAA Division I. And before that, he spent one season for Oregon State, working directly with the men's basketball program. And the years before, he was director of sports performance for Olympic sports at Buffalo, where he was responsible for the men's basketball and volleyball programs. And in addition, he was overseeing the Olympic sport performance department of four full-time strength and conditioning coaches that basically served over 300 student athletes. And this is something, Lennart, that probably will spark your interest, also mine, of course.
Absolutely.
Being a director of athletic performance, that's something I think we have never had a guy like that on our show. And I think we just get him on the show. He's waiting.
Let's get him on the show.
Sean, how are you? Nice to have you here.
Good, Dom, Leonard, great to see you guys. Appreciate you having me. Appreciate you making time for me. And yeah, excited to chop it up with you guys today.
Yeah, we are also excited to have you on the show. I mean, there's actually, the thing is, Leonard, I think first of all, we have to ask how Sean and me connected. That was actually a pretty funny thing. Sean, you wanna talk about this?
Sure. Yeah. So a week or so ago, you shot me a DM, and I guess, you know, First Beat came out with a document going over a training load in basketball that both you and I were quoted in. And so I didn't even see this document yet, but you shot it out to me saying you received the document, you saw my quote in there, so you looked me up, and would love to chop it up more over First Beat and connect. And so, yeah, through an Instagram DM a little bit ago, you reached out to me, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, that is a funny coincidence. And in that regard, you can, again, I have to stress, you know, I'm not always a fan of social media, but for these kind of things, it's actually pretty spot on.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sean, I'll try to introduce you a little bit. Was that all correct, what I said? I hope.
It was perfect. You did a phenomenal job. That was all correct. That was perfect.
Okay. Is there anything missing that you might want to stress still?
I mean, yeah, so that, you know, those last three stops actually were only the last 3 or 4 years of my journey. You know, I've done a lot of moving around and climbing in the coaching profession. So just, yeah, the real quick synopsis, you know, I grew up in upstate New York in the United States, was a basketball and a soccer player growing up. So those are my two favorite sports. early on really just fell in love with the preparation for sport. You know, basketball was my first love. I was a small, short, undersized kid kind of looking for an edge. And so, you know, right away in about fifth grade or middle school, started getting with a personal trainer and working on my vertical jump, working on my strength, all things that I think would help me on the basketball court. I ended up having 3 knee surgeries in high school, 5 knee surgeries total. So my playing career really got cut short, which put a lot more time into the weight room. And so when I went to college, instead of playing basketball, right away I started interning with the strength and conditioning coaches there and really getting my career going. I got a personal trainer certification, so I'm working general population people out. I'm interning in the weight room, working with athletes. I was doing research in the biomechanics laboratory. So I kind of saw all the different avenues that this, you know, exercise science profession could take us. But the relationship piece, the coaching piece, like I really fell in love with strength and conditioning and team sport. And so from there, I've had a very linear career path of a voluntary intern to a paid intern to a part-time, you know, a graduate assistant, a part-time coach, a full-time assistant to being a director to now, you know, being just with men's basketball at the high major level. Mm-hmm. So I've seen, you know, private sector, I've seen Division III, Division II, Division I, basically every single level that you can see in American strength and conditioning. But yeah, now really happy here at the University of Missouri. Great staff, great athletes that I work with. And it's a unique situation in American basketball in that, you know, you have the NBA, so you got the professional setting. I'm at the Division I level, which is kind of like the next level. You know, it's college still, but, you know, I don't know how much you keep up with it. But with, you know, NIL, name, image, and likeness, you know, college athletes are getting paid now. It's becoming very, very much more of a business and a professional type dynamic of prepping athletes for that next level of getting into the NBA. So creating, you know, it's a new day and age for college basketball, and I'm right in the middle of it. So it's exciting.
Mm-hmm. And since you already talked about the ladder you took in your career, and now you're not, like, your role was director of athletic performance, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Maybe you could enlarge a little bit about that role. What is added at this point to just in quotes, strength and conditioning coaching?
Absolutely. Well, I'll go back to, you guys hit on it, when I was at Buffalo and I was director of sports performance. So I oversaw a staff, just kind of the infrastructure and the quick history of strength and conditioning in America. You might have, you know, in the 1990s and early 2000s, you might have, you know, 5 strength coaches that work with a university. The lead, the head strength coach or the director was really working with football. And then you might have a bunch of assistants under him that also help with football, but are that lead for the other sports. It's really grown to where football is its own separate department. And then the Olympic sports strength department generally encompasses all the other sports that are non-football. So the director is usually the most senior person or the one working with a revenue sport like basketball, overseeing all the other strength and conditioning coaches. You're still in collaboration working with sports medicine, sports nutrition, all the other departments, but you're really just in charge of overseeing all the strength and conditioning. So when I was at Buffalo as a director, I only programmed for men's basketball and volleyball, but I would still have meetings with the tennis coach, with my assistant strength coach who was taking the lead on them, and kind of being a liaison of facilitating what the direction of the department is, what our overall philosophy is, still with allowing each individual strength coach some autonomy, but you're basically the mentor and leading them. That's in contrast to now my role here at Missouri, where I'm director of athletic performance. I'm only with men's basketball. So now it's at a higher level where football is separate, men's basketball, women's basketball, all that is separate, and then Olympic sports is all the other non-revenue generating sports. So I'm, you know, considered basically a basketball coach. I'm on the basketball staff. My office is in the basketball offices. But instead of me being like an X's and O's coach, I'm in charge of athletic performance, everything that's related to physical preparation. So obviously I'm the lead strength and conditioning coach. My role requires me to work very closely with sports med, very closely with sports nutrition and our sports psychologist as well. The root of my role is strength and conditioning. But as we'll get into a little bit here today, talking about, you know, the sports science, the data integration, you know, I'm in the meetings with the coaching staff laying out the practice plan. You know, it takes, it's a more of an outside the weight room role as well.
Absolutely. This really is a very interesting history, let's say, about the development of strength coaching also with college sports, which I really, here in Europe, I think it's going also in a direction like this, Dom, you would probably agree, but it's still more in the baby steps, I would say, right, Dom?
Yeah, I mean, we are not as professional as America is, of course.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I doubt that we're ever going to get there, but everything is on the way up, let's put it like this. More and more.
Gotcha.
I think in the first league, almost every team has a strength and conditioning / performance coach these days. Also, the Pro A, this is basically the league where I'm the strength and conditioning coach or performance coach for a team. There, it is not that far, but there are also teams who have a performance coach these days. But like I said, not as professional as in the US, of course, but you know, we're trending upwards for sure.
And also listening to how you described your role and in what meetings you're mm-hmm. sitting actually and giving your expertise, I think you could, if I get your descriptions right when we're on the phone off the record, it's kind of the same. Also planning practice, what player is available, how much can he put in today, what does the data say?
Yeah.
And I'm also like, and that's also a big point of, I think, what we always been stressing on this podcast and with Brain Pops in general, how you need all these different expertise to put together to get the whole picture. Not just the X and O's guys of basketball. Now strength and conditioning is moving up, I think. I think everywhere in basketball, people know how important this role is. And that you actually get the, let's say, status, like the expertise that you get listened to, and then also obviously the doctors and stuff. You said sports psychologist, and only like this you can paint the whole picture. And I think that's something really important in sports in general that gets stressed more in most of the programs to put this all together.
It's the most ideal situation, and again, being Division I in the SEC conference, you know, powerhouse basketball and football and just conference in general in America, we're able to kind of put the most ideal situation together and really try and be at the forefront of it. But I, you know, me had been through the full ranks of this, I kind of understand the limitations of it and why it's taken so long to get here. You know, when I'm at Buffalo or Eastern Michigan, where, you know, you're part of the strength staff and you're working with several different teams, you know, if you are responsible for training and coaching five different teams, you can't be in all those different meetings. And when you're not as present and able to have those face-to-face interactions and put the time in with those coaches, maybe they don't have as much trust in you or the relationship isn't there. And then so it's harder than to move up the ranks and get in this level when you don't have that previous relationship with a strength coach or trust or things along those lines, you know, and because we'll talk about this, the data and everything like that. But to me, everything comes down to your relationships and your communication, your ability to communicate that type of information. If I don't have a relationship with my head coach who's never been exposed to some of this stuff before, or I've never talked to him about it before, he might not have to have the trust in it to say, okay, maybe we're going to deviate from the plan or deviate from, you know, what I've done in years past. So I think trust, relationships, the time in with the coaching staff is incredibly valuable. That's why I think where we're trending in America to where, you know, it started with athletic training. Every athletic trainer, you know, doesn't have five teams that they work with. Most athletic trainers only have one or two teams because they have to be at practice at the games. They have to be in meetings. They have to be more present. At least that's how it is in America. Now, strength and conditioning coaches are starting to get that role where you're not going to take a job where you have 5 to 10 different teams at a high level. You might only have one or two so that you can have more of that type of role. But what I will say, taking a step back, is my first full-time job in America was at a Division III school. So I'm Division I now. Division III was the lower level. And my first job, I had 10 different teams that I worked with. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that at that level, because that made me a much better strength coach. You know, I had to go from working out the football team at 6 a.m. to the rowing team at 8 a.m. to women's soccer to men's basketball. So you get a lot of reps coaching different populations, different personalities. So that 100% made me a better strength coach. But, you know, where we're trending in our careers, if you want to have a seat at the table and do stuff at this type of level, you can't have 10 different teams that you're working with. You've really got to focus in and be with one team. But what I'm constantly stressing to my strength and conditioning interns and like the next generation coming up, I think if you only work, you know, with me and men's basketball, and then you get a men's basketball job where you're just with men's basketball, I think it limits your skill set a little bit early on. The same way that we talk about in sport, you know, general preparation to specific preparation and maybe getting exposed to several different sports early before you focus in on one in your athletic career. I think in strength and conditioning and the coaching career, I think it's the exact same thing. You need to work with as wide of a population as possible early on, really hone your craft of being a strength coach. Once you become a great strength coach, now you can start climbing up the ladder and only having one or two teams and then expanding your repertoire to some of the sports science stuff, to the practice planning and everything like that. I think it's a natural progression.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, maybe we can dive a little bit into what you said earlier about the relationships, the trust you need to build in order to use the data or whatever you want to bring to the table. Maybe you can explain a little bit your experience in the past working with different coaches and stuff and staff. What helped you to gain this trust, to build relationships in general? What were maybe some key factors that you always saw? Mm-hmm.
I think the first thing, and again, being in America, if you go back to the model where you've got a strength coach that's assigned to work with 10 different teams, I think the very first thing is the sport coach wants to know that you know their sport inside and out and value their sport. If you look like a stereotypical football strength coach and they know you kind of got brought on staff to help with football, but you're just kind of given the five other teams, they don't want the tennis team, the track, they don't want them doing the football program. They want this strength coach to know the nuances of their sport, the verbiage, the terminology, then obviously like the energy systems and how to train them. So the more you can immerse yourself in the sport and not talk strength coach speak, but talk coach speak to them, yeah, I think that's the first step. And then it just comes down to putting in time. Like you've got to make time. Even when I had all the teams at the other schools, I would make time where I would still go out to practice and be able to show my face and get the athletes and the coaches to see me outside the weight room. You know, it's very difficult for you know, and I'll use basketball as an example. When I first took the Eastern Michigan basketball job in 2016, they didn't have a real history of, you know, utilizing the weight room. The players didn't love the weight room. The weight room was an added stress to them. So if I sat in my role and only interacted with the athletes when they were in the weight room in an environment that was already foreign to them that they didn't want to be in, I'm probably not going to get a great relationship out of them. So by me being out at practice, by me going to the dining halls and eating meals with them and building that relationship outside of in a more comfortable environment for them, translated to now when they get in the weight room, there's already a little bit of that trust there where I can kind of coach them through it. And you gotta give them, you know, what they need on a personal level. Everyone doesn't want to, you know, do the cookie cutter stereotypical programming, especially, you know, everyone's perception is reality. So if their perception of strength conditioning is you're just going to make me lift heavy and you're going to train me like a football player, you need to sell to them what they need, what's individual for them. And even if some of the things that you know they need might look similar to that, you need to spoon feed them and give it to them in a way that's digestible to get the buy-in. And then for me, results speak, right? And so you got to measure everything. Let's measure where they're at when they come in. Let's measure the training process and the results that we're getting. And once they start seeing results, to me, that's the easiest way to continue to get the buy-in, you know, moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that those were some really good points. I also really like the point of adapting the language also, yeah, of the coaches. You know, talk their talk and not just bring in your own stuff and then showing results, measuring, and maybe that's already a good point to dive into the first beat system, Dom, unless you have something adding to that.
Yeah, I think, no, I really liked it as well. Like you just, I mean, I can only add also the showing up part I really liked, that you also, you know, I mean, for me, this is basically what I do every day, because I'm at each practice. So this includes showing up, of course, but yeah, being interested, of course, measuring something is really important. That's something I also found out. And another thing, just listening, of course, and at some point bringing things up that they told you in the past. That for me, that's what I have experienced, where then at least I always had the feeling that the guys were like, oh yeah, okay, he's actually listening to me. So
absolutely.
I have one question to add to that. No, I just realized that, because Don, we talked about it I think last week or something. What if you measure something, see something, or heard something, and you know the coach, or let's stay with athletes, the athlete doesn't really want to hear it, because his, you said perception is reality, because his perception is different, but he doesn't take something in account. How do you how do you work with that? Because you're strength and conditioning, and if you see something there, you got to tell them. And how do you tell them that they're not maybe too offended and are just like, ah, no, hell no, and I'm just objecting?
Yep. We've got our associate head coach on staff, C.Y. Young, has got a famous saying that he's always saying. He says, look, I don't get emotional, I just read the data. And so I approach athletes with the same thing, as you got to kind of cut back different layers to get them to see from the lens of everybody else, you know, and especially, you know, not to put down the younger generation, but you see it more and more where everyone's so focused only on their own lens. They don't really put them, they don't have the emotional intelligence, I guess, to maybe see things through other people's eyes. And so, yeah, as a strength coach, as someone that I'm going to be with the athletes every single day, I'm constantly teaching them and educating them and challenging them to look at situations through somebody else's lens, or to just kind of peel back layers of whatever situation it is. But I mean, for example, if there's an athlete that maybe isn't happy with playing time, maybe the coaching staff is getting on them saying they're not understanding the plays enough or whatever it is. Now they come into the weight room, maybe they don't agree with it. I'm fortunate enough where, as a strength coach, you know, I'm not affecting playing time. I'm you know, I'm part of the basketball staff, but I'm separate. So yeah, I'm going to be there as you know, like Dom said, you're going to listen to them and you want to show them that you care and that you're listening, but maybe you're going to give a piece of nuanced information that's going to resonate with them because you are disassociated from playing time. Whereas if a coach was trying to maybe say the exact same thing that I'm saying to them, maybe there's more of a barrier, a wall up, because the player feels that coach is directly responsible for the lack of playing time or whatever it is. So I've always found that me being on the outside of the coaching staff and being able to listen to them has helped that. And maybe I can then give some physical preparation suggestions or unique things that we're going to do in the weight room to make the athlete feel like they're actually working towards that goal or that challenge that the coaching staff is throwing at them.
Yeah, that's also a good point. All right, and then let's dive a little deeper into the topic we actually wanted to dive in today. And before we start, maybe for our listeners, maybe we always hear the term sports tech. Maybe you can just give us a short intro. What is sports tech? What does that mean?
Sure. So yeah, I always tell the story. It was actually 10 years ago now. I was a paid intern in the NFL in America with the Buffalo Bills. And our first day on the job, we had a meeting with Catapult, who came in to go over their GPS units. We were one of the first NFL teams to start utilizing that. And that was the most foreign concept to me, because I'm thinking we're a strength coach in the weight room. What do we need GPS for? Like a GPS was what I used to navigate to get to the job. So that was all new to me. But what I realized was from that experience, all they were doing was just quantifying volumes and intensities of practice. And that's all we did that year. And that always resonated to me because, you know, sports tech evolved for me to be a means of quantifying things that are already happening in coaching, but just getting objective metrics that you can communicate to improve that kind of cycle of coaching. You know, coaching is teaching, you know, teaching is motivating people to learn, or whatever, you know, phrase you want to use, but it's all completely integrated. And in America, we've seen over the last 10 years, the pendulum kind of swing to where everyone got so obsessed with sports science and technology, where everything was just about measuring and doing and adding in the latest tech. But the bubble got so big where the process around the data wasn't getting utilized. Like we have full sports science positions on different staffs where their only role is to take all the data and make spreadsheets and send it out to the staff, but they're not a coach. They're not coaching in the weight room. They're not coaching on the basketball floor. They're just spitting out spreadsheets to the staff that maybe doesn't even, again, perception is reality. Maybe the coaching staff doesn't fully comprehend or understand what they're trying to show with the data. So then there's really no action behind it. For me, it's got to be very much integrated within the basketball coaching staff and the strength and conditioning staff to just collect data that is naturally occurring that we normally wouldn't get. And then be able to communicate it to the staff in a way. I always talk about you got to collect data, number one, before you make any changes. Make sure you know what you want to measure. So for us, that means we're measuring body weight every single day. We want to get some type of a readiness metric on our guys, whether that is with the quick recovery test through First Beat, whether that's as simple as a subjective questionnaire. But we want to put some type of a metric to the athlete's readiness state. And then we're going to put some type of a training load metric on our athletes too. You know, in the weight room, we have Sparta force plates, so we're going to do some type of a jump testing too, which, you know, can lead into readiness or a key performance indicator. We've got, you know, tendo units in the weight room, which is giving us feedback on bar speed. And then once they hit the basketball court, we've got both Connexon and First Beat to look at internal and external training load. You know, Connexon is the external training load. It's going to measure, you know, the speeds, the distance, how many miles they ran, their jump height, their jump load, everything that they do. And then the First Beat heart rate monitors is the internal training load. It's you know, how their body responds to that external work that they did. And so overall, when you take a step back, you see, okay, we've got, you know, readiness metrics, we've got training load metrics. As a strength coach, I kind of know, you know, we have periodization. We know what the loads are supposed to, and the volumes and intensities in the weight room should look like. As a basketball coach, you do your periodization where you know what the volumes and intensities on the court and the practice plan should look like. All the sports tech and the data is doing is giving us objective measures of, did we hit the target that we were looking for? Did we undershoot it? Did we overshoot it? And then those type of conversations with the coaching staff, where we can start to mirror what the metrics look like compared to what we actually did, gives us a bigger lens moving forward to where we can get, you know, really specific with our practice plans.
Yeah, that was already a really interesting summary of how you include sports tech in your daily routine. But Leonard, there's already the difference. We use First Beat as well, but like you just said, you use First Beat and Kinexon. Yes. On top of that.
Yep.
Which is obviously pretty detailed, and I know Kinexon is something that is also, let's put it like this, not cheap. So that's where I see the difference already. In Europe, not for all teams, yeah, but for most of the teams, it would be either or.
Correct.
Either First Beat or Kinexon. Having both, I don't know, maybe in the top EuroLeague teams, yes, maybe, I don't know. But that's already something where we see a big difference between Europe and America.
And the other thing, I'll say that. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No.
No, no, I was just going to say, you're exactly right. I've utilized First Beat since about 2015, maybe 2016, when I was at a Division III school in Virginia, Christopher Newport University, which phenomenal basketball program for being at the Division III level. They actually just won the national championship for Division III a week ago. But being at a Division III school where you don't have a lot of resources, you know, I had a phenomenal coach that, you know, wanted to start to utilize technology and just keep expanding the program. He's a very forward thinker. First Beat was the lowest price point for us to kind of get into the game there. And that's truthfully the reason why we got First Beat is it was the lowest price point. We were able to get the best data. The dashboard is phenomenal. And it just so happened that we could afford it. So we got it. We started utilizing it. Saw a lot of success. I really liked the system. And then the more strength coaches across the country that I talked to, even at the higher levels that were using First Beat, were like, yeah, compared to everything else, this is a phenomenal system. So we just lucked out in that it was a lower price point, but you know, it turned out it was a phenomenal system. And so again, from Christopher Newport University to Eastern Michigan to Buffalo to Oregon State to now Missouri, I've been able to, you know, be able to use that system at a lot of different levels with a lot of different programs, and then slowly start to add other pieces to the puzzle with it. First Beat was always kind of the first objective measure that I utilized. And then again, the wellness questionnaires, I would use session RPEs, so all stuff that I would do through Google and send out to the guys and slowly start to build it out. But yeah, I just lucked out where, you know, we already had Connexon here at Missouri, and you know, a lot of the NBA and a lot of, you know, big programs utilize it. But yeah, to your point, Dom, the best thing to do, yeah, is to start small and slowly build it out. And then once you're really good at that, then yeah, the more information and in conjunction with external and internal, the better. Because how we use the system now, you know, our coaches, our head basketball coach, Coach Gates, very forward thinking, you know, and he doesn't do any conditioning tests. He doesn't make the guys run sprints at the end of practice. He utilizes the data from the information that I get to him, right? If our off season is an 8-week off season in the summer, we can look at the data week one and see, okay, this player came in, his external training load for the week was here. His internal training load was here. It was really high. Now, as we progress moving forward, all of a sudden, week to week, his external training load is increasing. He's getting faster. He's covering more distance. He's doing more work on the court. His internal training load is decreasing, meaning it's taking less out of him. He's getting in better shape. His fitness is improving. We don't need to do an arbitrary conditioning test just to see who's in shape, who's not in shape. The data is already showing that. You know, training, the testing is very much integrated within our system, our practice, and what we're actually doing. On the opposite end, in our in-season period, it becomes very important because naturally coaches are going to be messing around with their rotation, right? Some teams use a 7-man rotation, a 10-man rotation. Guys that maybe were getting a lot of minutes in the early preseason games, now later in the season maybe aren't getting the same amount of minutes. So I can do the same exact thing and look at their external training load. If their minutes start dropping and then week to week their external training load is dropping and their internal training load is increasing, now I know there's a deconditioning effect. And so now as a strength coach, I flag them, I identify them, and now with me, they're getting either extra reps, or in practice, we're adjusting the practice plan where maybe our scout team or our low minute guys, their volumes intensities are going to be much higher on the low volume intensity days for our high minute guys, just to balance out that training load week to week. But you know, we like to talk about having no gaps, right? So if we're not using the data to identify that, that's a gap where maybe they're going to slide through the cracks, and then all of a sudden they're deconditioned by the end of the year. And if there's an injury and now they got to step in and ramp up their minutes again, that acute to chronic workload is going to spike up. All this stuff being monitored on a daily basis, you know, allows us to make sure there's no gaps.
Leonard, I think you just listened to something that you had to listen to before when I was talking to you.
Yes, absolutely. But it's good to hear it from somebody else with other words, but basically meaning the same thing. And it just makes absolutely sense also from a player's perspective. You know, if I imagine if we had this a couple of years ago when I was still playing professional, you know, that's something adapting in season, you know, what's happening about your minutes, about the rotation, so you're actually, when somebody gets hurt, you're able to step up and don't get injured right away because you're ready, because you're not in shape, and it's not even your fault really, but you're just your chance that you usually would have by getting injured as for somebody else, you cannot use because you just wasn't ready.
One thing that I would like to stress, and in terms of first beat, because lately, a few coaches contacted me and were asking me how I use the system and stuff like that. And what I always tell them, the reason why I like it so much, because I think first beat is now known for his internal metrics. That's where they, like, internal means basically everything related to heart rate, where your heart rate zones are and stuff like this. But on top of that, and this is new, I think you didn't have that 10 years ago when you were using it the first time. Mm-hmm. It still has a little bit of external parameter.
Yep.
So, and that this then gives you context exactly like you just described. And that's something I also always recognize that at the start of training camp, you know, not every player was working hard in the summer. Let's say not everybody always prepares well. And that's what you then right away see. Yeah, they have maybe a high movement load, but also a high trimp, because everything they do on the court comes to a big cost. To a big internal cost. And then through the weeks of preseason, in case they don't get injured, obviously they get in better physical condition. Yeah, what happens? The movement load, the external load stays the same, but all of a sudden they just get more efficient. They have to, everything that they do comes to a lower cost. And then you can obviously say, okay, good, this particular player is getting in a better position. It's just getting, just improving his fitness. Yep. And this is, I always like to say, this is something you obviously want to be able to see if you use such a system. But then on the other hand, I don't know, and there I would be very interested. To me, it didn't happen that often yet, but in the past I had like two or three players who were not improving. Like, I mean, they were practicing, they didn't get injured, they were going through the whole preseason and the season started, and for some reason, these numbers wouldn't improve. Now it gets interesting, yeah? What do you do now? And how do you approach a player who is not responding to training or not responding in the way that you would like him to respond? What do you do then? Because just giving you the cliff notes, there was one player, you know, he was, everything we did half court was all good. Yeah. But once this player had to go up and down 2-3 times, it was just a matter of minutes that he was completely gassed and he had to stop. And then as a performance coach, you're standing there and obviously like, that's something I have to take care of, because that's obviously not possible. That cannot happen. So, but how do you approach this then? Did you have like anything similar? Did you experience anything similar in that regard?
Sure. And while I say you hit it on the head with the context piece, first off, with first beat, when I first started using it, they didn't have the external metric built into the system. And so, yeah, you would see a wide range of trimp scores for our athletes. And then that's the natural first question is, what's the context around this? Did the player with the highest trim score in either the drill or practice or whatever we're looking at, did they have to cover more distance? Is that why they had a higher trim score? So the very first thing you want to do is be able to put context around it. And First Beat understood that. And so naturally, they started with the external load metric, which I appreciated. I haven't truthfully done too much with the external load metric on First Beat, because since it got rolled out is when I've been using Kinexon. So I've been, you know, matching it up with that, but no, the concept is still there. And then to your example with the player, I think Leonard, when you talk about buying with athletes, that's something where you grab them after practice. Hey, were you starting to feel really gassed toward the end there? It's like, oh, man, yeah, that was way different than the half court. And then you show them the data, be like, look where you're at in the half court, look where you're at in the full court. And now all of a sudden for them, it's putting context to what they were already naturally feeling. They probably felt good in half court. They probably felt like, man, I'm not prepared enough for this full court stuff. Then they see the data that's going to validate that. And then you got to have your intervention. You got to either say, you know, for me, the first thing is I want to get them in the weight room with me. And it might be, you know, bike interval sprints, treadmill. It might be some supplemental conditioning, or I might push for them on the court. We've got guys that are gym rats, meaning they're constantly in the gym working on skill development, playing with each other. So I might try and make that a little bit more structured for them to say, hey, we need to really get you guys moving up and down and supplement what we're doing in practice here. And then, you know, if I can, I'm going to put the first beat on or try and quantify that while they're doing it. If not, when we keep watching practice moving forward, we're going to see if there's a change in their full court numbers, right? And then go back to the player. And again, how are you feeling today? Yeah, I'm starting to feel a little bit better with it. If their numbers are starting to trim, are starting to decrease with that, okay, now it's starting to click for them what type of a training intervention they need to actually get the results to optimize what they're doing on the court.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really, really, really important what you both of you guys stressed with like, this is the data, put it into context, and then how do you present it to the players or coaches? And the players especially, they need to feel it, really. And then, like, if you get that and they understand, then it's not just like, oh, strength and conditioning coach has me running and on the treadmill and this and blah, 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 blah. But now you're asking them, you may be even leaving them the autonomy of what do I want to do with this information? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If they already have an idea. And that's really, really, I think, powerful. And that can get overlooked by using this sports tech, because just having the first beat system or whatever itself doesn't do anything. Yeah.
And so with that, right, so to the example that we were just talking about, because we've got a similar couple guys in similar situations and they need more conditioning. They'll come in the weight room and they'll be on the Airdyne bike on their own, and I'll put the heart rate monitor on them. I'll put the iPad up in front of them, and I'll say, we're going to, you know, accumulate 4 minutes on the bike, you know, because in college basketball, it's basically 4 minute games, you know, from the 20 minute mark, then at the 16, 4 minutes in is a media timeout. Then from 16 to 12, then at the 12 minute mark is a media timeout. So every 4 minutes is basically a break. So we'll build conditioning around that. And they'll be on the bike for 4 minutes. They'll look at their percentage heart rate, and I'll say, I want you at 85% of your max heart rate. And I don't want you to go above that. Don't want you to go below that. See if you can maintain that. Because a lot of data in America is coming out that, you know, while you're on the court, it's basically built around, you know, 85% max heart rate or so. And so they'll be able to try and maintain that. And again, just the seeing 85%, knowing what it feels like, now all of a sudden down the road, you know, if they're on their own during a break and they don't have the heart rate strap, they know what that 85% feels like, and they know to accumulate certain volumes there. But then after the 4 minutes, you know, we'll give them a minute and a half or a 2 minute rest. They'll see where their heart rate recovery is, where it could drop. They'll know what that feels like, and then they'll repeat. So again, with the sports science or the sports tech, just trying to incorporate it into every, you know, not just practice, but in the supplemental conditioning and everything like that, get them as familiar with the metrics as possible to show that it is all integrated.
Yeah. And I think I also want to add an example I saw also with a team or a player that who was on the team that was using First Beat, and he was playing practicing with the first team, but also mm-hmm. with the second.
Mm.
And there was something really interesting, because that really paints the picture of also bringing in psychology, because in first team, the practice, the load, the external load was basically, let's say, the same as in second team. Mm-hmm. But in first team, his load, internal load, was way higher. and his condition doesn't change between the practices or something. Right. But mentally, his fear of making mistakes, his fear of do I belong here or anything else made him not recover well, you know, and that's like the biological, psychological, social connection in us humans that we all have that really brings the data also into that. And now you're talking with a sports psychologist. Hey, what's going on here? How can we help him? You know, what do we see here and why is there a difference?
Oh, absolutely. That's funny. We see the same thing. The first practice of the year, the same thing. The internal training load is through the roof. It's the first time the guys are playing with each other. It's the first time they're in front of the coaches. And so even if the external load isn't that high, it's that first couple practices, you see a huge spike in the internal load.
And you know what I like to say always when I can observe this, as because I did observe this a lot of times with youth players who are practicing in the second and the first team, like what Leonard just described. And then I always say, the sensor doesn't really know the player, huh? Mm-hmm. So the sensor just tracks what the sensor always tracks. So, and then if you see that the internal load is way higher than compared when this particular guy is practicing on the second team, I think that is just if it's possible that you as a coach can know these things, yeah, you obviously want to know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Sean, there's also one other topic. I always like to say that we as performance coaches, that in the end, we are not able to predict or prevent injuries, but our goal is to manage risk.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And through the use of a monitoring system like FirstBeat, it can be also something else. It doesn't necessarily have to be FirstBeat. I think through the use of this, we can decrease at least risks. And there was one podcast you were in, and you talked about one very interesting topic. You were talking about defining the rate of loading. Could you maybe enlarge on this, what you meant by that? Because I think that's very important. Like in our position, that it's important to define the rate of loading.
So, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong. I probably was talking about the rate of loading in terms of like acute and chronic workload. Right.
Yeah.
So, and in our jobs, it's extremely important because this goes, you know, as a strength coach, most strength coaches understand proper periodization and what, you know, your week one, week two, week three, week four is going to look like and how we're acclimating our athletes to the training load in the weight room. Like we really grasp that. We understand that. What I found is sport coaches, basketball coaches, maybe they don't have the same grasp around the practice plan and what the training loads. And when I talk training loads, normally I chop it down to just the overall volume and then the intensity of it, because they kind of understand that. And as strength coaches, when we program, you know, five sets of five at 70%, like we understand what the volume is, we understand what the intensity is. What, you know, especially now, I started really speaking on this during COVID, when we had you know, the lockdowns, and now we had a very shortened, condensed season, and it really got put on the forefront of basketball coaches saying, okay, we've got basically, we didn't have any prep period in the summer. We're going right into preseason. We've had less time to get the work that we need in to prepare them for the season. And right away, I started talking to our staff and kind of consulting other staffs just on, you know, proper loading into you know, you have your floor, and then you've got your ceiling. We could say the ceiling is where, you know, normally the first week of the season, the training loads the guys are accustomed to. The floor is where we're starting. Normally our floor for us in American college basketball, in June, we start up our off season. The first week of November is our first game, of our season. During COVID, our first practice came in September. So we had a whole couple months months of a wash. And now if you just expected to do what you did the previous September, that loading was going to be way too high because our preparation level was way below the floor. And so I had to talk to the coaches about just being coaches, understanding this type of information and then modifying it for the current environment and situation that we're in, and then slowly, you know, progressing. In strength conditioning, you know, we have the term progressive overload. In coaching, I think it's the same thing. We need to understand that it has to be a slow progression to get us to where we want. The misconception is that you don't want high training loads. High training loads is what the game is. High training loads is what we need to get to. The fallacy and the issue is our way that we get to high training loads. So just to take a step back, we'll use Connexon, we'll use First Beat to quantify what the games look like, what a week looks like, and then we, you know, reverse engineer it and start backwards of building our practices to slowly get us to that level of high training loads. COVID-wise, we did a phenomenal job. What we did was we realized, okay, when does our team need to be at their best? For us in a one-bid league, meaning March, our tournament in March was really what was going to determine if we went into the NCAA tournament. We needed our guys as most prepared as possible in February and March. We didn't need them as prepared in November, December. So what we did was we just extended the ceiling out, meaning our guys maybe weren't as cumulatively as prepared in early November as they should have been, you know, a year prior, because we just kind of extended our preseason preparation period into it, which allowed us to successfully progressively overload our guys into handling higher training loads a little bit later in the year. And that worked out where, yeah, we fortunately didn't have any injuries. Guys felt prepared versus other teams where maybe they started at full throttle in September, October, and were already a little beat up by then. So again, it's communication with the coaching staff. It's communication with the players. But yeah, you know, acute and chronic workload is, some people are all for it. Some people are kind of against it. Me, I'm neutral. I just think we're basically talking progressive overload here. In season, if you've got, you know, 7 days in a week, two of them are a game and one of them is off. So basically it's a six-day week for us. Two games, four practices. If we've got a low minute guy that maybe isn't playing in those two games, now all of a sudden that's a third of your week that they're not experiencing training load. If you know anything about the acute chronic workload ratio, if you drop below one third, now all of a sudden you're in the red zone of being underprepared. And then if you've got a guy that goes down with an injury, now that underprepared athlete has to step in and get high minutes. Now that training load spike is so high, and that's what we talked about before, where maybe we see some injuries that we could possibly prevent. You know, I don't think strength conditioning prevents all injury. Injuries happen, it's part of sport. But, you know, to your point about the risk, the more we understand this type of stuff, the more we can alleviate some of that risk that often gets overlooked.
Could you maybe just for the listeners, I'm not sure if everybody is familiar with acute to chronic workload ratio. Could you just explain what acute and a chronic means?
Yeah, absolutely. So acute basically meaning the work that you put in for this week, what's your training load for these 7 days, and then chronic, you know, in the research is generally a month or 4 weeks. So your acute workload is your training load for these 7 days. Your chronic workload is your workload that you've done over the last 4 weeks. So to put it in simple terms, if I'm going to go run, say, 10 miles a week, and you know, over 1 week I'm accumulating 10 miles in a week. Over 4 weeks period of time, that's 40 miles that I'm running. Now all of a sudden, so you know, I'm used to averaging 10 miles per week. If now in the fifth week, all of a sudden, I'm like, I need a break, I drop it to 5 miles and I cut my training load in half. The acute chronic workload ratio basically is saying 0.8 to like 1.3 is a safe zone. 1.3 and up is too high. 0.8 or below is too low. Meaning, if I go from 10 miles a week to 5 miles a week, You know, 10 divided by 10 is 1. So if I do another 10 miles a week, I'm right on par with what I'm prepared for. If I drop it too low to 5, it's going to drop me into that underprepared red zone. If I spike it to 15 miles instead of 10, I'm adding too much too quick. I'm in the red zone. So it's just kind of finding that sweet spot of where you can have little modulations of what you're prepared for. You can have a little bit of a lighter week, but not too light. You can start to slowly ramp up the volumes, but not too much. So it's kind of just parameters to, again, a progressive overload to get you to where your goal is.
Really, if I listen to it, it's common sense, but common sense absolutely. put into numbers and actually to measure it, because you know you
that's
always
exactly
have
what
the
I
risk
you're absolutely
of being too subjective and thinking, hey, I needed to go faster or this is too fat, blah blah blah. Yeah,
absolutely.
And what I always like to say when it comes to load management, I think in the end we want to prevent doing too much or too little, and again that goes into the common sense kind of thing. Yeah, and if you really measure everything that the guys do, you're obviously in a position to see, like to recognize trends or even red flags. Yeah, yes. And if you're able to detect that, that obviously again drives better decision making. And these layers of information, if you can have them, you obviously want to have them. What you do with it in the end, yeah, that needs to be communicated through the coaching staff. And I have one more question, and I think maybe afterwards I can tell you guys how we use it. But how do you use First Beat or Kinexon in a rehab setting?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's perfect. So same thing. If you've got a guy that's maybe getting higher minutes, one of your better players, and now all of a sudden he has an injury and maybe he's out 2 weeks, whatever it is. Now we need to pinpoint, okay, the injury should heal in 2 weeks based on our return to play. But when is he actually going to start accumulating smaller minutes in the game? When do we expect him to be at 100% and have the same minutes? And so you got to kind of map out what your loading time frame is. And then again, start with the data that we've accumulated. Here's what volume and intensity, or you know, is trimp and is trimp per minute, or with Kinexon is acceleration load, accumulated acceleration load and accumulated acceleration load per minute is during a game. And let's work our way backwards. Let's see what a high practice would look like for him. Let's see what a moderate or low practice would look like for him. And then early in the return to play, those are the metrics that we're hitting. And then we're going to shut him down at a certain point early on. If he hits the numbers that we're looking for on a given day, we shut him down and then we slowly progress it back to where he can get minimal minutes in a game till he can get full minutes in a game. But again, if you're not assessing, you're just guessing, right? If we don't have those actual numbers, we might do a similar return to play plan, but we don't have the objective feedback coming in that we can be more precise with what each day looks like or when we feel like the athlete's actually ready to be full go.
I have a quick question to that, maybe a little bit off topic to college basketball, but I would be still curious on your opinion. Since in the NBA, there's a big talk about load management, minutes management after injury. And, you know, some players sitting out games probably because of some type of this data that we were just talking about. And I get why programs are doing it, but then now the other side is saying, hey, they get paid for 82 games plus playoffs, yep. And, you know, yep. This is their job. What's your take on this?
So my take's probably a little bit unique because I see both sides of the spectrum. I think, you know, and I spoke on this in a webinar during COVID, you know, right when The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary, was coming out. And that's when everyone's like, man, Michael Jordan didn't do training load. He, you know, he never did load management and sat out games or anything like that. And the answer for me is somewhere in the middle. I don't think we're comparing apples to apples here. I think it's apples to oranges. The NBA is so different. The demands on the players are so different. the game is so different. Okay, just look at spacing. Look at the tactics of the NBA and the three-point line. You've got the same amount of players on the court for each team, five, covering much more space than they covered in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s now because of the three-point line, at a much faster pace. The game, you know, some people argue it's not as physical. I would argue it's just as physical. So the external load is significantly more in the NBA now than it was, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. The offseason isn't the offseason anymore, you know, because the, you know, with the playoffs and then all of a sudden, you know, if guys got to do summer league or whatever it is and then preseason, the guys really don't have much downtime. And especially if we're talking about in the last 3 years since COVID, yeah, you condensed the season, but the offseason really wasn't there. Now you're right back going into the next season. So guys really haven't had any fully time to recover whatsoever. But to my example about, you know, where's the floor and where's the ceiling? Where do we need guys to be prepared at? You know, this is just my opinion. I feel like the NBA model, the performance staffs know they need their franchise players, their star players for the playoffs. That's going to be the most important period for them. So they're willing to say, hey, we're going to extend out that ceiling to the playoffs. The guys aren't at full preparation in December, in January, or before All-Star break. And that's where they're building chronic capacity. Bless you. That's where they're building chronic capacity. And that's why they are starting to sit guys and monitor load, because guys aren't at 100% of chronic capacity until after All-Star break, when it gets closer to playoff time, when it actually matters. Now, so from a scientific standpoint, that makes perfect sense. As a fan, if you're paying money to go see a LeBron James, a Kawhi Leonard, whatever it is, you don't want to go pay to watch them sit out. So it is kind of a two-edged sword there that I don't have the exact answer to. I just kind of see it from both lenses. Yeah,
absolutely. And also, you back in the day, you didn't have the data, you didn't have the science behind it. Yep. And now, yeah, if you run a business and you see the risk you would probably take, yeah, you know, if the star player is playing today or not, yeah, you know, I want you to be in that situation and say, F it, let him play.
Yeah. right.
He'll manage it, you know. But yeah, there's always two sides to it, and the truth is somewhere in the middle.
It's a business. There's big money on the line for all that. So yeah, I completely understand it. And yeah, it's going to be interesting over the next couple of years where they go with it, because it is a hot topic where people were, you know, very anti-training load to now guys understand. It's got to kind of find the balance somewhere in the middle here, and I'm sure they will over the next couple of years.
Len, I wanted to add one more thing to what Sean said in regards to how to structure a rehab process. So like you just said, the good thing is if you have every single team practice of each player analyzed, you obviously know what their, you know, what their loads are, like the maybe a high load, medium, low load. Yeah, what that means in, for example, the metric movement load. Yeah, what kind of mechanical stress the player usually goes through team practice. So, and if you know all this, then you can obviously also come up with a nice rehab like plan. For example, somebody severely twists his ankle, and he is first of all out for 2 weeks, and he can obviously still lift. He gets treatment all the time, but then maybe after 2 or 3 weeks, he's cleared for on-court work. Then instead of saying, okay, today we work 15 minutes, tomorrow we work 25 minutes, and the day after we maybe, if the structure allows it, work for 45 minutes. No, now you can build up practices based on movement load, based on mechanical stress on the court, where you're like, okay, good. First practice, let's see if you can go through 75, through a movement load of 75. If you can do this and you come in the next day and the player is like, okay, my ankle feels fine. All right, good. Then let's try to go to 100 and slowly add that up until this particular player reaches a high load that he experiences through team practice. Yeah. And if he can then go through these workouts, I always like to say he needs to go through this movement load that resembles a high practice at least twice before he can slowly start with team practice again. So in that way, you make it way more, let's say, you come up with different stages that are tailored to the guy, to the individual player. And when you went through this, I always have a better feeling of putting a player back in practice instead of that I'm saying, okay, today 30 minutes, tomorrow 45 minutes. Yeah. Because the minutes doesn't say anything about what he was doing, like mechanical stress-wise.
Absolutely.
So that's how I do it, or we do it over here. Hopefully, we don't have to do it as much.
Well, and then for Leonard, from a psychological standpoint, as a coach, we feel more confident with that data, and because when we put them back in, we know the mechanical load they're about to go into is the mechanical load we prepared them for. So as a coach, we're more confident, but then as a player, you're more confident too when you're communicating that data. That's the biggest thing with the return to play that I see is players lacking confidence in how we strengthen their knee, strengthen their ankle, and getting them back in. But when you've got the data to and explain it to them just like that, how here's how we're progressing you, it's not just the amount of minutes that we built you up for, it's actually extracting the mechanical load you're going to be exposed to, and then we progressively overloaded that. So here's what you're about to step into. You already have done this and you're prepared for it. From a psychological standpoint, the athlete's going to be much more confident as well.
Great point.
Yeah, very,
yes,
very good point. Yeah. And then obviously it allows you as a coach, when you know this particular player, and then you can maybe observe that during team practices, compared to the others, he's not really getting up to the movement load he was going up to before the injury.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have at least, it leads to conversations, you know, at least you can go to him and ask him, hey, are you okay? I mean, you know, the numbers didn't, we're not where you were 6, 7, 8 weeks ago. And this, again, like I said before, it just gives opportunity to create conversations with the player.
Awesome. I think we're already in like an hour, right, Dom?
Yeah, it's. I have so many more things here, but we could speak for hours. Sean, is there anything you would still want to add where you may be like, okay, that's something that's still interesting or...
Yeah, man, I would just reiterate, you know, because we did talk a lot about the data. I would just reiterate, you know, you got to first figure out what it is you want to collect or what problems do you have in your program. Again, if I'm going back to 2015 when I'm at CNU, we couldn't quantify the actual loads of practice. We couldn't quantify the readiness of the players, which, you know, lit a light bulb in my head going back to my time in the NFL with the Buffalo Bills and using Catapult and figuring, you know, when I left the Buffalo Bills, I'm thinking, man, I'm not going to be able to do anything that I did with them in my current situation at a D3 school because we didn't have the money. And the money wasn't the issue. It was the principles that we were working within. It was, how can we quantify readiness? How can we quantify training load? How can we kind of incorporate this all together? And so, you know, readiness and training load started out as a free thing for me at CNU, where we would have a subjective wellness questionnaire to kind of put a metric to what their readiness is coming in for the day. We would do a session RPE, just you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how tough was practice multiplied by the minutes of practice to put a metric to training load. All that was done for free. And then we started to slowly add some objective measures when it comes to first beat, and looking at, okay, what's the quick recovery test score as a readiness? What's our actual trimp and trimp per minute for volume and intensity of practice? But we figured out what we wanted to measure. Then we collected it. Then it took me to actually review the data and kind of make sense of it. The third step for me was, you know, communication to the coaching staff, athletic trainer, to our players. And then the fourth step is what I call recalibrate, because we would just, you know, it wasn't a huge change. It was just a small recalibration. We knew where we wanted to go within our annual plan. The data and the communication of it was, okay, we hit the target. We were slightly under, we were slightly over, and then we would make small adjustments to our coaching plan already early on. And then that kind of feedback loop is what we maintained throughout the year till we slowly built our ecosystem more and more. But the problem with data that I've seen is people get so excited about it. They'll get first beat for the first time and they'll run conditioning drills and they want to just make massive changes to what they're doing right away. And I think that's the improper way to do it. You've got to be a sound coach and know what you're looking for already, and then just use the data to slowly extract things that normally you wouldn't see, and then use that feedback loop to progress moving forward.
Great point. I think we should get money from First Beat for saying this, for airing this. So if anybody's interested, we need to get like a promo code in this episode going. And but also like that one point you made in the end, I really want to stress again from a psychological point. If you come in with a First Beat system or some system, and then you just say, okay, we're going to change everything or a lot, people are not going to like it. People are, you don't want to change so much. And because the message people forget, if they come up with great ideas and changing stuff, they always forget. The message they send is the old stuff is whack, you know, and, that's not a message you want to send, you know. And so I think your way of how you just explained it, how to implement this was really, really great. And I think that's the way to do it.
Absolutely.
Dom, anything you want to add?
I think, I'm just going to read it out. I just want to add his quote from the first beat training guide, because I think it's just so spot on. And you just mentioned it, and you also mentioned it in the beginning of the episode, but I really liked it. And that basically sums this topic up in a nutshell. Is that okay, Lennart? Can I read it out?
Go ahead.
The first beat data quantify something that is already happening, but we normally wouldn't be able to see. We can objectively quantify recovery and objectively quantify training load instead of just relying on the eye test or guessing. Getting that information and using it is really valuable.
And that leads us to our last question.
And I haven't even, I think I haven't even told Sean. Maybe let's see what he comes up with.
So it's a surprise for you, but we ask this question every time we record a podcast. So great show with you. We really liked what you brought to us. Thanks a lot. Do you know somebody that you could bring us in touch with that would be also interesting for this podcast maybe?
Oh, 100%. So... you know, I was listening to your guys' podcast. You guys had Alex on before
Alex
me.
Arama.
Yes. So Alex actually does some consulting with us here at Missouri. We work with him. Our basketball staff, you know, utilizes the constraints led approach. And so one of our assistant coaches, Matt Klein, is someone that I worked with at Eastern Michigan and now work with at University of Missouri. But if you're looking for more of a technical, tactical coach to come in and talk about how, you know, my communication with the coaching staff and then how they're utilizing it on the court and practice planning and seeing more of a basketball coach perspective, Matt Klein, who's an assistant coach here at University of Missouri, would be phenomenal and kind of be a continuation off of what Alex said, what I said, and awesome. Everything moving forward.
Nice.
Awesome.
Nice.
That sounds very good.
Yeah, we'll definitely ask for some contact. And that leaves us to say thank you so much for being on this show. I really personally had some brain pops. I hope the listeners had some brain pops, and maybe you could even take something away from this.
I did as well. Absolutely. Dom and Leonard, thank you guys so much. This has been great for me too. I took stuff away from you guys, and so this was it's been a great morning for me.
Awesome.
All right, Sean, thank you so much.
Yep, thank you guys.
And here we are in our after show. This is where Dom and me drop our take-home messages, aka brain pops, about this past episode. Dom, this is someone who, like you said earlier, he really has skin in the game. What did you take away from Sean's expertise?
I mean, there are so many things that I really liked. And, of course, This is my topic at the moment. This is my topic, especially for this season. I'm really trying to dig deeper into that rabbit hole. And what everybody always says is that you can also lose yourself in the numbers. And this what I'm experiencing right now. And that's why I'm always trying to take a step back sometimes and check what numbers are really necessary. And what numbers I can really work with to hopefully stay as efficient as possible.
Yeah. I really liked what he said in the episode, that you need to know what you want to find out before you start measuring. Otherwise, it happens that you lose, like you said, yourself in the numbers.
Yeah. And, you know, this is only my second year and let's say my first year where I really used this system, well, to an extent that I've never used it before, but I would not do it without it anymore. And this is something that I really like, what Sean said, that in the weight room, it is a little bit easier to quantify stress with volume and intensity and stuff like this. And without having a system, like a monitoring system, like, for example, First Beat, It is tough to quantify load for basketball practices. Yes, there are ways. Yeah, you can look at the live minutes, the full court live minutes, the half court live minutes, the overall live minutes. That's also what I do as well. But then, especially when it comes to rehab processes or when it comes to being able to decide on the fly if, like, a practice session that we are doing at the moment is where we are getting into a zone, this which is maybe way more than what we usually did. I mean, you want to be able to see these things. That's why I really like what he said with overshooting, undershooting, or reaching the target zones. I think that's really important because we also said in the episode, and that's what I also communicate to my coaches. I tell them, guys, I don't really know what's the optimal training load. I don't even know if that exists, and I don't even know if somebody claims, if a coach claims that he knows what the optimal training load is. I don't know. I would question that, but if I can say that right now we're doing something that we're probably used to in terms of looking at the last 4 weeks, that's something you would like to be able to know, of course, and then you want to build your decision upon that.
And I think there it's a good help for making some type of decisions, especially what we talked about in rehab process and bringing players back, or when it happens that they get their numbers up. And but in the end, it's really about, you need to know what you want to find out. Otherwise, this is just some numbers, and it's objective, but then it's really subjective how you read it. You know, you can get a lot of numbers, and then, you know, he said perception is reality, and whatever you look for then pops up to your attention, and then it's really subjective what you read out of those numbers. But if you know what you want to find out, then it's a different story. And then I think monitoring systems like this can be really gold.
Yeah, and one other topic that we also haven't touched upon in the episode, sometimes players and coaches come to me and they're like, yeah, but these things are not accurate. And I agree. I mean, they are accurate, but in the end, they don't show you like the reality for 100%. So there's probably, you know, there's probably a mistake in that system. But what you should not forget is this mistake is consistent. So it's consistently inaccurate. Yeah, and then you got to see if that's consistent. Yeah, then you still get something you can work with. And we also, there are so many other things we even didn't touch in the episode. For example, you can get reference values for individual players and for the team for different practice days. Yeah, based on how you plan your practice per week, you want to have a high day in your practice week, and one day before the game, you want to have a low day. Yes, but this is, everybody plans that a little different. But if you come up with these reference values, it's again easier to decide, okay, we should stop here, or maybe we can do another drill. You know what I mean? So there, yeah, these numbers do make sense again. Or the margin of success these days gets smaller and smaller. Yeah. What you could also track, and that's like now what we said before, you can also lose yourself. But if you, I don't know, if you have a player who has a great game, yeah, and you want to see what the practice load the week before prior to that game was, you can obviously look at it. Mm. Yeah. And maybe you find some correlations. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but there, yeah, I think that's the margin, really. Like you said, there you can also get lost, because I think
exactly, yeah,
yeah, you know.
But then,
yeah, but
then,
I get what you're saying.
But
I get
then,
what
Leonard,
you're saying.
If a player gets injured in a situation, and you can go back and look, okay, what was his acute load when he got injured? Yeah. So there, yeah, it does make sense again. You know, if you can quantify, yeah, that, you would like to quantify that. I think
I agree. No.
So yeah,
you
like,
can quantify a lot of stuff with this this system, and yeah, as long as you have an idea of what you want to do, I think this is a great help. Yeah,
yeah, and you know, it's not black and white, and you should not live and die by it, but you definitely get a way better look at things.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I guess we wrap this up, right?
Yeah, we should. And I have to cut down on the word obviously. I think I said that 40 times during the episode.
Well, it's your new favorite word. And yeah, it sounds good, obviously.
All right.
Yeah, all right, Dom.
I had fun. I really liked
it.
And I'm looking forward to the next episode.
Me too. We see you guys. Oh, we hear you guys in 2 weeks. And until then, have a good time. Have some brain pops. And yep, let us know how you like this episode in any type of message or contact form that is favorable to you.
Bye-bye.